Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Clubs in Forum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find more about the organization and events online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. Tonight we're here for Food to Change the World, finding justice, health, security, and sustainability in good food. I'm your moderator, Jason Mark, editor of Earth Island Journal and a co-manager of Alamany Farm here in San Francisco. We'll be tweeting the best of tonight's dialogue from Inforum's handle, at InforumSF, and with tonight's hashtag, FoodForChangeSF. Joining us for tonight's think tank are Nick Saul. He is the CEO of Community Food Centers Canada, the former executive director of The Stop, and the author of the new book of the same name, The Stop. Raj Patel, a food justice activist, academic, and author of Stuffed and Starved, and also a really great book, The Value of Nothing. And Nikki Henderson, the executive director of People's Grocery in West Oakland. Tonight we'll be bringing our own individual experiences and perspectives together for a free-form discussion, brainstorm about food justice and how fighting for food, good food can transform our communities in incredible and unexpected ways. Tonight's discussion was really inspired by Nick Saul's work at The Stop and his new book, which chronicles the really inspiring story of how he transformed what was a small food bank into a national movement, one that I think we can all learn from. And so before we sort of have a discussion among the four of us, I want to invite you, Nick, to tell us about the story of The Stop. It's really incredible.
Thanks. Well, first of all, really nice to be in San Francisco. And I just want to say that the book is co-authored with my wife. And if it hadn't been for her, there would be no book. She was unbelievable, and we are still happily married. So, maybe the best thing to do, I have a few minutes to talk about some of the key themes that are in the book and that are relevant, I think, to this conversation. And the first thing is that the narrative spine of the book chronicles my 14 years working in a very low-income, culturally diverse neighborhood, and much like in the U.S., the racialization of poverty is very much alive and well in Canada. And when I got there in 1998, it was like thousands of food pantries, you call them food pantries here in the U.S., it was a dreary, embarrassing, under-resourced, hand-to-mouth operation. We had a couple staff, lots of volunteers. And it was a place that you had to check your humanity at the door before you walked in. And when you did walk in, you had to keep your eyes on the ground because you didn't want to look at other people. It was a dispiriting place. Physically, it was falling apart. I'm a big believer that the physical determines the social, and maybe we can get back to that at some point. And then when you got through the maze of questions and to the front of the line, you were handed basically fat, sugar, and salt, and off you went into the day. And it didn't take a rocket scientist for us to figure out that what we were doing wasn't helping anyone. And to make a very long story short, because it was kind of relentless incrementalism over a lot of years, we started by simply listening to people. I'm always shocked how few people listen to people. And when you listen, people have a lot to say. And our community was pretty clear that the transaction, the us and them, the giver-taker of the food bank was not working for them. And they wanted to be cooks and gardeners and engaged citizens and volunteers and be part of creating a better community for themselves. And so we decided to not only listen, but to respond. And over many years, we started to build more participatory and less stigmatizing programming that allowed people in to the equation. And food is a really powerful way to do that. And so when a Bangladeshi immigrant comes to the city and finds himself in our garden and he meets others and he figures out what he can grow in this climate in Canada and take it back to his windowsill or his backyard, or when someone from Ecuador arrives in our community kitchen and together with others they plan a menu, eat it together, and take food home. Ostensibly they're there for food, but they're there for connection, figuring out what resources exist in the community. So we built farmers markets, fresh market stands, community kitchens, community gardens, congregate dining meals, perinatal health initiatives, all on this premise that food is really powerful. So that's kind of one strand that goes through the book. The other strand in the book is this idea that change happens because you fight for it. The minimum wage, the weekend, the women's right to vote, civil rights movement, those things weren't given. They were fought for and won. So in our organization, we married direct service, meeting people where they're at in a really dignified and healthy way, with this commitment to speaking out about the larger structural issues that were driving food insecurity in the first place. And we live in an era, particularly in the NGO world, where we're ducking those responsibilities of speaking out about this stuff. And I don't mean that in a partisan way. I think that what we simply said is, these are the conditions we need in our community for our community to be healthy and safe. We need good schools, we need good parks, we need libraries, we need access to good food, we need people who have good jobs that allows them to live with dignity and health. And when they hit rock bottom, we need social entitlements that support people to bounce back, because people do want to bounce back. Poverty isn't about being lazy or being a poor budgeter or a character flaw. It's about low minimum wages. It's about inadequate welfare. It's about health care here that's way too expensive, housing that's too expensive. So this political piece of our work is extraordinarily important. And we were relentless in meeting with our local politicians, doing film nights, community events, training community members to speak about their stories and then link it to the public policy process. So that's another key theme that is very central to the community food center movement we're trying to build. The third thing is the idea that food is a public good. Food is a public good. If you simply view it as a commodity, as we have for far too long, we are in deep crisis around issues of climate change and poor health and inequity. And so what we have been saying in our neighborhood is that we need to create a societal consensus that food matters, that food cannot be left completely to the marketplace. And what I mean by that is, there is this kind of vote with your forker, you know, middle class good food revolution that's happening. Well, it's happening, but if you're rich, you get organic and local, and if you're poor, you get diabetes. That is a problem. So what we're trying to say is that we need to tax soda, get junk food out of schools. We need to ensure that the school lunch programs are actually sourcing food sustainably and locally. We need to ensure that people aren't attacking food stamps. We should be talking about how inadequate they are. We need to be talking about how fast food workers get paid next to nothing. So that's another piece. Food is a public good. We can return to that. I'm running out of time. The fourth thing is that you need to build organizations that reflect the future you want to see, that are more inclusive, that are more just, that are fairer. And the last thing is that food is powerful. I think of a guy like Glenn, who had a really miserable childhood, became an alcoholic at a young age, built a business, the economy wiped him out, he ended up working at Home Depot for next to nothing, got injured, then ended up at the Stop. And I always say, never underestimate the power of a great meal cooked with love and eaten with others. He came into our center and he found himself, he became a volunteer, part-time employee, went off and got a job. And when I saw him, just as we were finishing writing the book, he had just been coming from, he got off a tram and he had just been coming from a course in photography, because he was going to retire and become a photographer. So his transformation through food and through dignity, food is never just food, and it's powerful, and we use that to good measure in our community food centers. So now we're trying to expand the concept that we built in the Stop across the country through a new national organization called Community Food Centers Canada, and I should be quiet. That's a lot. Okay, so a few things.
A lot of things.
Well,
thank you so much, Nick, for sharing that with us. I guess I'd love to ask you guys, when you hear Nick's story and you hear the story of the Stop, what do you take away from it, both sort of lessons and also questions? And I'd love to open that up to the audience as well. What are some of the questions that kind of immediately come to mind when you hear Nick's story?
Well, I was really excited to hear about the politics, to hear that what the proper job of a food bank should be at some level to put itself out of business, that there's something undignified about a society that depends on food banks that look the way they, certainly the way they do in America. And so what I love about what Nick's done is really taken the idea that, of course, we need, there is, and I use his language, and I've been using this, and I'm really grateful to him for it, there is a dignified emergency among the poor. And that is, and so that's not about pauperism being met by, sort of cans of whatever is just about to rot, but instead a community where there is dignity and love, but also politics. And it reminds me of the Black Panthers, because everything does. The Black Panthers were organizing in West Oakland to end, they had survival programs, and these were called survival programs, about survival pending revolution. But they recognized that if you want social change, you need to meet people where they are, and if they are hungry, then you do that. And they, at their height, were involved in feeding more kids than the state of California was feeding through their free school lunch programs. But it was combined. It was the food and the politics together, the food and the means to end needing to live on handouts, but actually to recover your dignity and to fight and to organize for change. And so I guess I wonder, that's what I'm hearing, and that's what I'm really moved by. But I'm also wondering, Nick, about the sort of constitutional limits to that, certainly in this country and what you've seen in Canada, because food banks are in the business of shifting pounds of food, and the most successful food banks are the ones that feed, that shift the greatest weight of food. Now, that seems to me to run very sort of contrary to what the stop's doing.
Well, first of all, we're not a food bank. I want to be really clear. So what we've done is we've embedded all of these programs. The food bank is still there, and we've improved the quantity, quality, and cultural diversity of that food and really put a focus on healthy food. But it's these other programs that has been the cultural shift in our organization. And in, getting just quickly back to the politics, I have seen over the 15 some odd years that I've worked around food injustice, the big food banking systems, and they are big, they're juggernauts. They raise $5 billion in the U.S. is raised through the 202 big food banks in this country. What I've seen is increasingly them reluctant to speak out about the issues as to why they're in business. And this is a significant problem, in my view. You can't run from that conversation. And I think they have a very different theory of how you create social change than the one I tried to describe around mobilizing people. And it is done through this idea of government relations. And it's very clinical. And you meet with a bureaucrat or you meet with a senior legislator, and that's what happens. We're in the business of trying to create pressure from the outside. And I do think it is an inside and outside game. You have to have both. And so that's where we line up, that we need to be creating pressure so that when you can meet a progressive politician and a progressive bureaucrat and you have an active civil society pressing, you can see change on whatever the issue might be, increasing welfare or more affordable housing or whatnot. But that, you have to politicize the conversation, not necessarily partisan, but it has to be politicized. We need to build organizations that are more progressive, solidaristic, and politicized. And we don't have enough of those.
And Nikki, what were your sort of thoughts when you were hearing about the stop? And I know that you've met Nick before, but knowing about his work.
I think one of the things that really struck me was the complexity, because it is very hard for, at least in my conversations with people, it is either emergency foods or self-determination. We're going to take care of it completely ourselves, and it's never that. And so the idea of emergency services for people being connected to the long-term view. We're going to do the Band-Aid now because it's needed, and we're going to start building toward the longer thing. It, for some reason, that seems hard, at least in larger conversations. Either you are all for the Band-Aid and you're for emergency services, or we are systemic. And I think I love the fact that it's so clearly both, and that both really work. And I think one of the questions that came up for me was, it comes from a very personal experience. I mean, People's Grocery got funding from the California Association of Food Banks for a while. Bless them, because they were trying to figure out how to get money to groups that were doing work on the ground. And we had so much trouble with the types of questions they were asking to quantify impact. Mm-hmm. You know, when it came to if the more meals that we are distributing, that we are using a dollar per person to quantify, and the types of materials we're distributing to people. But there's an experience when people learn about nutrition and then start eating healthier, and that's why they come back to our events to get the meal. There's a lot of the story that's lost. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the questions that I have is, when there is that transition, because it is a dignified struggle, what it takes for someone to go from I needed emergency services to I'm no longer needing emergency services, that story and that path, it's such a beautiful journey, and it's such a teaching tool for others to know that they can do the same. And I think that emergency services actually play a large role in that. It's the person that's serving in the food line that has the conversation with someone. It's the conversation that happens over dinner where there's 2 5-year-olds talking to each other about how their parents cook. There's so much that happens in that space, and I think my work is so rooted in that when it comes to how people help people do better in their lives. And so maybe it's less of a question and it's more just a reflection of why those political programs are so important from the human person-to-person level. We do need to shift the systems, and those political systems, those political programs need to exist so that we can shift the system. But they're also important so that families can talk to each other, and so people can sit around at the table and figure out how to help one another make all of our lives better.
But I also think that moving away from the transactional relationship, which is at the bedrock of the food bank, which it's you line up, you get the food, you go home, it's transactional, that our work is about trying to create relationships, which is what you're describing. Mm-hmm. And when you create relationships, it's much easier for someone to say, yeah, I want to go meet my local politician. I got something to say. Or I might grab a placard and go on a demo. You know, I'll never forget being at a press conference with the food bank czar of Toronto, who was launching this important campaign called Pay the Rent or Feed the Kids. And after the press conference, the lights had gone down, she came up to me and said, we need you to like activate this campaign in the community. I said, that's why we're doing gardens and kitchens. That's why we're doing it. We're not, you know, a community garden is not going to solve hunger. Like, let's be clear about that. But it's a place where relationships can be built and activism can happen. And I'm not trying to suggest that everyone who goes to the stop is some raving radical. But it is, if you don't have that bedrock of relationships, you can't start to talk about what needs to change in the neighborhood.
Do we have a question or a reflection from anyone in the audience? As we get the way over, as we get the mic over to that gentleman, I do want to ask you, because you know, one of the big questions that is really at the center of this whole conversation around food justice, and Nick, in your book, you talk about, you know, making sure that the folks who are coming to the stop have agency. Right, that they become cooks, they become gardeners, they become advocates. And I guess this is really the big question, right, is how do we go from food security, which is essentially saying the right of everybody to have the nutrition that they need, to food sovereignty, which is the right of people to control what they're going to eat and how that's grown and how it's going to reach their family's table. So that's the kind of question. I know that's like the $64 million question, but how do we go from food security to food sovereignty? I mean, how does that kind of tipping point happen? hot potato.
Well, I mean, I don't want to belabor this point, but I think that when people are cooks and gardeners, they have a sense of their own self-worth and they have a sense of hope. And I'm a big believer that those are two key ingredients to both individual change and community change. If you don't have those two things going on, you're not going to get off the couch. So if anyone asks me, what are we in the business of doing? It's building hope and self-worth through the power of food. I think one of the interesting things to try and talk through is that, particularly as it relates to the food banking industry and this new kind of community food security approach, which is more preventative, upstream, holistic in the sense that it looks at equity and health and the environment and community, is that, you know, I certainly walk this line between the fetishization of food, you know, like that crazy person who goes to Madagascar to eat that beautiful mushroom underneath the palm tree or whatever, which is problematic, and then the commodification of food, which I've tried to describe, is problematic. Now, the food banking world is actually built on viewing food simply as a commodity. You know, it's just fuel for the body. Mm-hmm. The problem is, as they were established in the 80s as a temporary emergency, that's become people's full-time pantry. And that has caused enormous problems, particularly from a health perspective. I mean, you know, diabetes alone in the U.S., $225 billion spent on diabetes. It's a diet-related illness that affects the poor at twice the rate the wealthy. So I think there is a new kind of theoretical framework that kind of emerged in the 90s, that saw food in this more holistic way. And I'm excited to see, and I'm going to be a bit more hopeful about the food banking world for a second here, is that there's a new generation of leadership that's coming up that is seeing food in this more complicated and ultimately productive way, from my perspective. And so there's a recent conference in Tucson of kind of renegade food bankers who are trying to, you know, think this one through. So I'm excited to see some of that develop, because they have a lot of resources, and if they can start to flip some of these pantries into, you know, community food center-like places that come at it in this diverse way, I think that's a really good thing, and politicized way as well. I think mm-hmm. that's a really good thing to hold on to and try and nurture and push.
Raj, you've written a lot about food sovereignty. I mean, how can we sort of get to that, I don't want to say deeper level, maybe it is a deeper level.
Well, I mean, I think the very idea of food sovereignty itself is kind of a moving target. People, when you say food sovereignty, you get half a dozen definitions. And that's largely because you have a lot of different people who are iterating this different definition. You know, the original definition was about states and unions' right to be able to shape their own food system. And the definition that came out last month from Jakarta is food sovereignty is about an end to all forms of violence against women. And you have a range. And of course, there's some depth to that, right? I mean, that actually there is some structural structural violence in the food system, and that's why. The group that's most likely to be food insecure in the United States are female-headed households. Why, if you look at the people who are going hungry in the world today, 60% are women or girls. I mean, these are sort of issues that emerge from people grappling with this idea of food sovereignty. But there was a really interesting set of conversations that happened a couple of weeks back where Via Campesina, the international peasant movement that does stuff around food sovereignty, was sort of subjecting this idea to some critical scrutiny. And there were some areas where it's harder to see the food sovereignty kind of working on the ground. One is thinking about the relationship between rural and urban. I mean, food pantries and food banks. As you say, I mean, if there are gardens nearby, those gardens are not productive enough to be able to feed mm-hmm. everyone who needs it. Mm-hmm. Figuring out the relationship between that and farmers in urban and peri-urban areas who are able to feed people within the city, that's actually a tough question to solve because you have lots of different political constituencies there. And also there is this question of how do you farm? How is the food that ultimately comes here? Is it industrial agriculture or is it something more sustainable? And I think these questions are ones that I was hoping that we might be able to wrestle with here in our little think tank after we've heard from the audience.
Yeah, please.
I guess this kind of throws off the conversation, but I was wondering how you think technology could improve the circumstance, or what you're doing at your organization to integrate technology to improve the situation.
Yeah, I just figured out Twitter. Wow, that's complicated. I actually think that technology is more of a problem than anything else. I was talking backstage that food is one of those things you actually have to go back in order to go forward. And when I think of technology, I think of the most depressing article I read last year in the Boston Herald about this new state-of-the-art food bank in Boston, it was a $35 million capital campaign to build 120,000 square foot ode to finding a Twinkie on shelf 35 to get to a poor person at wherever. And, it's terrifying to me that in that article there was not one line that talked about why it was that this was happening, that we were building these logistical, state-of-the-art places. So, I mean, technology doesn't rear its head that much other than as a mobilizing tool to get people out to whatever the activities are. But, I'm more...
Technology is really having a revenge on us.
Nikki, go ahead.
Yeah, Nikki, is there anything you've done at People's Grocery that sort of used technology in an innovative way?
So this is a deep conversation.
It is.
I feel like People's Grocery started as a youth organization, and so there's always this cutting edge of, we can text all these people and let them know where this thing is. And so I think what you're saying about technology as an organizing tool, we've been experimenting with some community organizing software that allows us to do our work better. But I think the point that feels more significant to me right now is what you said about going back to go forward. Because when I think about technology, I think about biomimicry and how people in the food world have the opportunity to look at living systems and see how complex and sophisticated they are at getting things done and then model ourselves accordingly. And there is technology in the way that plants grow. There's technology in the way that seeds germinate. And how can we use that to feed people and feed our families and to nourish? And so that's why it's a deep conversation, because our social systems aren't necessarily biomimicry per se, which means funding doesn't necessarily flow through biomimicry per se. So trying to figure out how to do that in the nonprofit context is difficult, but we're experimenting with it.
And agroecology is sort of that too. I mean, agroecology is taking, you know, I like to think of it as taking 21st century science and grafting it onto ancient wisdom.
Yeah.
And so your rootstock is the ancient wisdom of growing food in a sustainable, humane fashion, and then taking, you know, the best science from researchers today and finding a hybrid between the two.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the issue of farming, which I'm not a farmer, don't pretend to be a farmer, but, you know, I think there is an enormous fight over where we're going in terms of farming. And right now we have a political economy of farming that is just creating disasters, both on the health and the environmental file. And so, you know, we do, and here's a place where we do, food is viewed in a public good, but maybe in a negative sense, because we subsidize to a very significant degree oil, commodity, monoculture, chemical, low wages. That is the current kind of dominant ag system. And, you know, when I was talking earlier about how do we create this notion of food as a public good, I'm always looking for public policies that bring equity and sustainability together. So, for example, in the school lunch program, I mean, it would be good to start to see 10, 20, 30, 40% of those purchases on local sustainable food. I think that could have an enormous impact on the countryside in terms of the kind of farms that are out there. There's a whole new generation of farmers that is extraordinarily exciting that doesn't want to grow soy or corn and 12,000 acres of it in a big tractor, right? And we need to find ways to get them on the land to grow multi-crops, smaller scale, selling directly to consumers. So, I mean, I think that is a big fight that our collective tax dollars could play a very significant role in terms of trying to change, to move away from the dominant paradigm that is creating, you know, farming creates 30% of our greenhouse gases and pollution in terms of the movement of food from field to table. So, agroecology is something that needs to surface and be ultimately re-engineering our subsidies to support that kind of ag. And whether that has some technology connected to it.
Can I ask a follow-up there? Because I mean, we have Esperanza Palana here from the Oakland Food Policy Council. And that reminds me about the importance of some of these conversations are about, well, we need to shift the way that U.S. agricultural money is spent, and we can see how successful Congress is at getting anything done at the moment. It's almost doing the same as they did last week, I think. One of the ways in which you can see change, or one of the venues or levels you can see change happening, is at the municipal level. I'm wondering if you see, I'm asking everyone, seeing spaces or examples where these municipal successes have actually, you know, gotten important victories, whether in Toronto or elsewhere.
You know, I do know that the urban agriculture policy that was passed recently in Oakland did free up a lot of space for people. And I think that at the municipal level, when it comes to, I always go back to this realm of people talking to people, you know, and communities of people actually being able to do more things together. And I know that urban agriculture for people is just really confusing. That's what I got more than anything. Can I grow this? Can I sell this? Will I get fined for having a rooster? A rooster is really legal, but then my neighbor has a rooster, but then I heard it's illegal. And if I sell this, can I get, and do I have to get this permit? Because I heard you didn't really have to get the permit. So I think things like the urban agriculture policy were really, it allows, even if people don't understand it still, because I feel like a lot of people still don't understand what the heck happened in the city of Oakland around urban agriculture, but it frees up the space to talk about it. And so I think something like that, it would have been very hard for me to see how that could have happened at a larger scale than at the city level. And some of the conversation about people growing their own food and being able to exchange food and being able to take food security at a very personal level to their neighborhood and to the rest of their city has been incredible as a result of city policy. So that's hopeful for me.
I mean, Toronto had the first food policy council, I think, in all of North America. The problem with our city government, it's a constitutional creature of the province, and so and it only has property taxes. So while the Toronto Food Policy Council has been very important to bringing together unusual suspects around a table to support the proliferation of farmers markets, to fight for school nutrition programs, to certainly push hard on issues like minimum wage and inadequate social assistance rates. So they do take very strong positions, but they don't have a lot of money. And so it has been, I think it's very, very useful, but at the end of the day, much of the money is held provincially. So the big fights, whether it's in ag or whether it's in health or whether it's in kind of equity justice stuff, it does sit with the provincial government. I just keep returning to the idea that, you know, in all of the work we're doing in terms of building these relationships, that we cannot be detached from the political process. That's how change happens. It's not going to be like kind of off the grid farming. It'll help a few, but we need to actually battle, regardless of how dysfunctional we think Congress is. And I've been in the States for now a week and a half, and I've read with terror, gobsmacked by the attack on the poor around food stamps. You know, the House reps saying, like, the just egregious stuff around how people are lazy and sitting on a couch. Like, those things are, and, you know, the conversation should be about, and so that's the issue. Like, how in this climate of finger pointing at the poor, do we start to build a politics of legislators that are actually responding to a different narrative out there? Or how does the narrative that maybe we all think is out there, maybe more so in California than in other places, that actually surfaces the kind of politics that we think are important to build a kind of healthy communities that people can access good food and realize whatever dreams and hopes they have for themselves or their kids? Like, that to me is the fight. And you know, it's not by doing a deputation, or it is by doing a deputation, but and doing a research paper, but ultimately it's about how do you build something in the community that is putting some political heat to the behinds of politicians who really only respond to whether or not they're going to get reelected. And so the fellow Glenn I talked about, I'll never forget when he had a big megaphone in front of our local politician's office saying, I was hungry yesterday, I'm hungry today, the way your policies are working, I'm going to be hungry tomorrow. And you know what we did in our community? The fellow who ran our civic engagement work became our MPP. Well, that was big, and we're still putting heat on his behind, but he's one of ours. And so I think you can, and this comes up in the book, that I think you can create conditions that you have a politics that mirrors more the kind of values that we're talking about today. But that's the fight. That, to me, is the fight. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to invite the audience to, if anybody's got an answer to Raj's question, what are some of the things you've seen at the local levels that you found to be encouraging? Yes, sir.
I'll see if I can hit all of the above.
Oh, wow.
Jewel.
First, I want to bless you all.
Thank you.
And all the people behind you, especially your wife, who have been doing this work for so many years. I'm going to continue to be the leaders and pioneers for us. Nikki, your comment about is there an do we focus on the emergency type services or do we focus on the fully sustainable? In actuality, there's both. I'd like to present that not as a either or a both, but as a continuum. As a continuum where there is someone starts off in emergency services, feeding the poor, feeding the welfare, feeding the elderly, whatever that is, and maybe at some point they may or may not become a place like The Stop and some of the other organizations that are out there doing this stuff. So I want to just encourage people to think about if anybody's doing the incremental emergency-based, think if you're funding them, supporting them, doing philanthropy, what are the next steps any of us can be taken to move towards the fully sustainable programs and look at it as a continuum. You know, what's next month, what's next year, what's the next 5 years. There's also, Nick, you were talking about feeding community gardens will not feed everybody. You're right. It's no kidding. However, they're the right direction. They will feed many. They will help change the mindsets of everybody. And you know this. I'm not lecturing you. They will change the mindsets of many. It will help shift all of our lives, in our children's lives, in our family lives, in our community lives, in that direction. It'll also be a place, as you mentioned, a place for the relationships and places to put a stake in the ground. Here's where it is now. Where do we need to go from here? And I don't want to ever say the Stop is done. No one will say that. Mm-hmm. Stop is looking at the political system and other sustainable methods. And also these kind of community gardens begin to shift the economics, making more local, more sustainable, and build models for the future.
And let's do one more comment or observation.
Well, okay.
Those are all good comments.
If any or all of you would like to comment on what are some of the steps that some of the more incremental emergency organizations can be taken to move towards sustainability, what's one step or two steps each could take? Thank you.
And your relentless incrementalism, which I thought, by the way, was a great little phrase.
Well, the first thing, I'm always surprised at how few food pantries allow people who use the service to be volunteers. It's a very simple thing, doesn't cost you anything. In fact, unleashes all sorts of capacity in your organization. That's a pretty simple thing. I think the other thing I would say is that you have to say no to some things to say yes to other things. So you have to say no to crappy food. And that's tough, because it's tough biting the hand that feeds you. But you got to say no to the palate of whatever it might be, fat, sugar, and salt, and say, that's a health crisis in our community. We're not going to take it. And I think the third thing is that you can't let the doing overwhelm the politics. You have to create space in your organization to be political and never assume that you're an answer to the problem. So those are three, things that some trickier than others, but you have to, like this idea of saying no to say yes to other things is somewhat straightforward at one level, but it's hard to do. And you got to draw a line in the sand. And then the truth is that once you have something that feels differently, and we haven't talked, I'm shocked that no one's asked about funding. And that we'll keep it at that. I know you want to ask. We can talk about it afterwards maybe. But, the truth is that once you have something that's different, that is, we're doing a lot of metrics and evaluation to show that it's making a difference, people are attracted to that. Funders come out of the woodworks, both private and public. And we're a fairly traditional NGO. We have to do, a whole assortment of events, direct mail, corporate, trade union, you name it, to raise money. But when you have something that is moving the dial on issues, people do come to it. And so I think you gotta, there's some very simple things. And the book is a bit of a manual at one level. You could read the book as a manual that reflects on this relentless incrementalism about how we got from A to B.
Nikki and Raj, what would you guys say is a sort of positive or even radical incrementalist step?
Again, pretty simple, but go into partnership with an organization that is doing the self-sufficiency stuff. Hmm. People's Grocery has a fellowship program where we work with residents who have their own ideas about how to improve the health and economy of West Oakland through the food system. And there was one woman who I think was houseless at the time, and she was visiting a food pantry regularly but wanted to do a cooking class. And so she got into our fellowship program and did a cooking class and then ended up getting really engaged in our events, ended up going to one of our events where we did a forum on jobs in the food system, and ended up getting a job with Revolution Foods. And so I think that that story doesn't have to be as unique as that, because a lot of the people that we interact with, if there's more direct connections that can be made between an organization like People's Grocery and food pantries that are in local communities, then there's all this space to be created for folks that have ideas and want to do stuff and just don't really have any avenues to do it.
One of People's Grocery's partners in Detroit does mm-hmm. fantastic work, and they recommend three things, just running with this idea of listening.
Yeah. Right.
The organization is called Cook, Eat, Talk. So they cook, and then they eat, and then they talk. But what's interesting is that it's about getting people, and it's sort of micro-local organizing, around the table for organizers to listen to what people are doing. And I was, again, really moved by Nick's first observation that actually listening is a hard and rare thing to happen in these emergency services, because it's like you're taken away by the breathlessness of the emergency. It's like, people are hungry, we've got to run. But the listening is part of the emergency service. And organizing to ensure that the local needs are met, I think, is that moment of taking the emergency and bringing the dignity back in. And so there are tools, there are organizations that are actually making the space to be able to say, look, we understand there's an emergency. We're meeting the emergency, but let's create that space to actually talk and do things that you're not meant to do over food, like talk about politics. And that I think is a very, very good thing to be doing while you're eating.
As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's Inforum. Connect your intellect. For more about Inforum and its upcoming events, please visit facebook.com/InforumSF or follow us on @InforumSF on Twitter. Tonight we're hosting Food to Change the World, Finding Justice, Health, Security, and Sustainability in Good Food. We're here with Nick Saul, CEO of Community Food Centers Canada, Raj Patel, author of Stuffed and Starved and The Value of Nothing, and Nikki Henderson, the Executive Director of People's Grocery. I'm Jason Mark. Nikki, you write at some point in the book that a lot of people are invested in the charity model. And this does kind of maybe get into your question of funding. And it brings to mind, of course, the famous quote from the Brazilian archbishop. He said, I forget exactly what his name was, you know, when I feed the poor, they call me a saint. And when I ask why the poor are hungry, they call me a communist. Mm-hmm. So when you ask why the poor are hungry, I mean, that must rub some people the wrong way. How have you dealt with that? I'd love, you know, same question really for everybody. You know, when you go and you start to peer behind the curtain, that discomforts some people who may be your funders.
Well, I think I need to be really clear that I'm not trying to villainize food banks. I'm just suggesting that we need to channel that compassion and human urge to help others into a more progressive project. I think that's what I'm trying to say. And in fact, I don't know if the gentleman here works in a food pantry, but another thing is that you might go upstream and ask the big mother kind of food bank that is raising all sorts of money, instead of putting their dollars into new trucks and new facilities, but to actually decentralize the funds into the community sector and build these kind of stop-like organizations. It's possible. Michael Moss's book, Sugar...
Salt, Fat, Sugar.
Salt, Fat, Sugar. Great book. He talks about a bliss point in your mouth that manufacturers create. Psychologically, neurologically, physiologically, this kind of emotional moment in your mouth that you just want to eat more and more of it. I think that there is an equal bliss point in the food banking world. And it goes like this. There's this humanitarian urge to help, which is a good one, right? There's lots of waste within plenty. We throw out 40% of the food we produce. We have governments that are looking for good corporate glow. And we have corporations. Slip there, but corporations that are looking for good corporate glow. And then we have governments that are in retreat from supporting people with their basic needs. That's a real bliss point that leads to private charity, neighbors helping neighbors. And some people see that as the embodiment of a good deed. I see it as the dissolution of our kind of social fabric, right? Our collective responsibility to each other. That is a significant problem. And it drives people into, I want to help the needy. And it is a massive industry. Everyone in this room knows that private charity isn't going to solve hunger, right? Hunger is about poverty, pure and simple. So this bliss point is a really tough one to battle. But you just got to keep pulling the curtain back and like being very forceful on the political side of how we're going to get out of this. Good wages, good welfare rates, good jobs. I mean, it's pretty basic at one level.
I mean, you're talking to someone who doesn't mind being called a communist,
right.
but that's why my current project is unfunded. but while we were doing it, I was in Malawi and we were looking at this amazing agroecological farming system, and it was the time the Republicans were first mooting the cutting of the food stamps. So I asked one of the farmer leaders there. She goes, I was saying to her, look, the Republicans, they're cutting food stamps in America, and she goes, oh yeah. And I was like, well, so what do you think of that? And she goes, well, it's good and bad, isn't it? And I was taken aback. And I said, well, so what do you mean by that? And she said, well, obviously, there's no reason for anyone to be going hungry. And there's plenty of food in America, and there's no reason why any child or any old person should go hungry. But you don't want people to become dependent. And so what she's doing is when she is giving her food away, she's teaching people who do conventional agriculture to do agroecological agriculture, so that next year, once climate change has hit and decimated everything, they will actually be more robust. Because this year, the farmers who were farming with conventional agriculture were nuked. And the agroecological, the rich sort of, alternative kinds of sustainable farming mechanisms were actually doing much better. But what was interesting there was this idea of, look, the way I'm going to take care of you is to make sure that you can, there is this sort of self-sufficiency, but also this sort of political community that comes together around food. So I must donate to you, but I also want you to be able to stand on your own 2 feet. So I'm going to lift you up.
I mean, that's sort of the flip. It's not like give a man a fishing rod. It's like give a man a life raft. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is agroecology in the 21st century, right? It's like the it's not just the fishing pole. It's like the whole system that's going to hopefully provide the resilience we need.
Mm. Yeah, this dependency argument is like tricky because
it is.
Like in the UK, food banking is just off the charts. They're exploding over there. Why? Because of the austerity regime of the current government and the stripping away of social entitlements. And look, I've worked for 20 years in low-income communities, and I've never come across someone who wants to be poor, wants to put cockroach traps around their baby's crib so that they can have an uninterrupted sleep or send their kids to school hungry. I've seen a lot of kind of food banks that will say, you can only come 3 times because we don't want to encourage dependency. What do you mean? No one wants to be dependent. People want to work. Yeah. They want to realize whatever they want to realize. And so it's such a right wing, I think, this idea that you're poor because you don't want to amount to much. Man, in all my years working in low-income communities, I've never seen anyone who has said, yeah, I want to I want to be here. No one wants to be there. There's no life or style in being poor. So it's not a lifestyle choice, I'll tell you that.
What exactly is the question?
Oh yeah.
Oh, we're all over the math now.
Jason's lost it.
I could absolutely wax poetic about this dependency thing.
Well, let's hear it.
Because that is a land mine. I mean, what it reminds me of, Nick, is what you were saying about, basically what you were saying was, how do you change the hearts and minds around this conversation? Especially in the political dialogue, and show people that the gap is actually not that wide between people and people with different circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that over the last 11 years, that is what People's Groceries work has increasingly become about. Mm. We went from this economic solution to this economic solution to small gardens to large farms, and we were on this big kind of rise. And then we realized that Oakland was this incredible opportunity to get people who had no exposure or real interaction with poverty day to day to interact with people who are in struggle every day.
Sure.
And these people eventually become politicians, mm-hmm, who make decisions. Mm-hmm. So if we can create the conditions for folks from different backgrounds, sure, to actually interact with one another, that will change the hearts and minds. And one of the best ways for people to interact with each other who are from different backgrounds is over food. Because it's a non-stressful, depending on what you're doing. But even stress in the kitchen is actually good. If you have an argument because my grandmama peeled these things that way and your grandmama didn't, that's a great conversation to get into an argument about. And then you actually learn about each other. And then it cultivates things. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the complexity for me when it comes to the dependency argument is that I think, this is going to be controversial, warning, controversial, my parents have worked in the foster system my whole life. And I have had the opportunity to see young people from age zero who were born in a bathroom grow up between 21 different foster homes, emancipated 18 off a cliff, you know? And sometimes they come out angry, and they come out wondering how to game the system so that they can get a paycheck, right? Because no one has ever given them anything. They think the system has screwed them, and they want as much as they can take from people. And I think that there is a certain... I think that there are people with a certain politic who interact with folks that have given up, who are very angry, and register that as dependency and register that as entitlement, but don't see the pain behind it and don't see the circumstances that caused it. And I feel like it's really important for people who work in low-income communities especially to have access to the level of complexity that is the bucket of poverty. People all across the spectrum live in poverty, just as people all across the spectrum are wealthy. There isn't one type of mentality or one type of way of interacting with the world, and it's holding that whole bucket of complexity that gets really exhausting, I think, for people who are social change agents, because you have to look someone in the eye who may be trying to screw you and love them and say, what is your story? Let's talk about this. And then create a space for all different types of people, like the people that you're talking about, who don't want to be poor, who don't want to line the traps up around their baby's crib, to talk to each other so that we can give each other hope. And so part of I think why I bring that up is because that's part of why I think my work has, part of why social change work can be so difficult, because it is complex. And if one of my funders comes into one of our programs and hears a conversation that maybe reinforces certain conservative viewpoints, right? But you don't have context for that, the context, which is complex, then you end up coming out with these incredibly just wayward opinions and perspectives. So that's also why I think these politicizing conversations are really important, because if everyone has politics, no matter what they are, then we can get into a conversation about how to change together and how to transform together.
And there's also a lot of programming that you can do that actually brings folks who would never cross paths together. We run a project called YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard, which supports
That's great.
Community members who are living in, you know, basement apartments or in really dire circumstances with single family homes, you know, homeowners that have grass in their backyard. And we create a marriage where folks will go and grow food on that grass and maybe share it with the homeowner or walk with it or contribute it back to the stop. And that, you know, it's a bit of social engineering, trying to, you know, bring people together who otherwise wouldn't meet. I think a lot of our campaigning work around welfare rates, 50% of people in Canada who use food banks are on social assistance. It's a big issue. And so we are driving hard to increase levels of welfare. And there's no question that 50 letters from Alcina in a more tonier part of our neighborhood go a lot further if they're aimed at politicians than 50 letters from Lawton, which is in our more low-income neighborhood. And so we're trying to create, you know, whether it's faith groups or middle class and low-income communities, to bump into each other and understand that, you know, the stereotypes just aren't there.
Yeah.
And I also think the power of storytelling. I mean, not that I'm trying to sell a book, but the book is all about stories.
Yeah.
And you know, stories have a way of, when they're unvarnished or they're just like not ideological. Like there's Glenn. That's Glenn. Glenn is not a lazy guy. He has fought all his life to try and make good. Or Nicole, who came from St. Lucia, was in an abusive relationship, had three kids, went to school, is now going to be a nurse. Like, she has fought all her life through a lot of stress, and getting out of poverty is not linear. There are ups and downs, and you can't judge. You just got to be there to support. But stories are really powerful. And so a lot of our work is about surfacing those stories, telling those stories, and making sure people understand that this is what people are going through. And I think, I don't know, stories can change the world, you know, when you get them out there.
Yeah, we've got at least one question right here.
Hi, I just wanted to build on dependencies. I just had a thought in terms of how there are organizations out there that allow you to donate livestock so that you become self-sufficient. And so I was just interested in your point of view of that. You know, there are many international organizations that do that, and so I'd just like your point of view in terms of kind of supporting that self-sustained environment.
The sort of Heifer International model.
Well, I mean, my perspective is that it's, I mean, a cow can be an important part of a good agroecological system, but it's also, I mean, it's important to have the rest of that infrastructure. I mean, you know, if you have a cow but you don't have land, if you don't have access to resources or assets, then the cow's not going to do terribly well, and then you'll do what most people do with, you know, in distress sales. The cow is basically a walking bank. And at some point you'll just cash that in. So I do think that, you know, in terms of if you're doing a single agricultural intervention, giving a cow away isn't a bad idea, but you shouldn't just be doing one thing. I think that gets to what we've all been saying here, is that interventions to make the world better have to be complex. They involve sort of cross-class interaction, and they have to, you know, acknowledge where people are.
Yeah.
Nikki, any thoughts on that model? Well, unfortunately, we're coming towards the end of our time. I do, though, want to give each of you a chance to offer a little bit of a closing thought on this whole conversation. No pressure, but kind of what is the killer app for reducing obesity, health, environmental impacts, hunger, poverty, and everything through food?
You said the killer app? Is that
the killer app? Yeah.
Like application?
Yes.
Wow.
But if that's too much, just 2 minutes on sort of your thoughts from this discussion.
Angry Birds, isn't it?
Exactly right.
Bubble Witch Saga.
Okay. I mean, I've spent my life working in the not-for-profit sector in low-income communities. And as part of this national project to scale the STOPS model across the country, I've traveled a lot. And what I've seen are people doing extraordinary things in the worst of conditions, in, you know, basements and plazas and ceiling tiles falling down and paint falling off the wall. And I really firmly believe that our work needs to be valued more. And we are fighting hard to create organizations that are financially stable, that are well-staffed, because staffing leverages volunteers. You've got to have core staff at the heart of any organization. And so my theory of change is that you have to have organizations that are stable, that are going to be there year in, year out. And I actually think that the work we're doing, there is an opportunity to be very clear that the kind of preventative upstream work that we're about through, say, our gardens and kitchens and the various other programs are actually an enormous societal benefit, and in fact saves taxpayers money. And so I think, you know, I don't want to get too crass into this, but we spend in Canada $50 billion on poor mental health. We spend $12 billion on diabetes. These are big juggernaut issues that are only rising in volume. And I think our interventions are really important to try and turn those numbers around. And so we need to have funded, stable organizations that are always there in dignified settings, that when people walk in, that you can meet them where they're at. You can build the relationships. You can build hope and self-worth. And you can actually fight, because, again, this key theme of change happens because you fight for it. It needs to be part of every one of those organizations. But, you know, I was talking to Nikki. Nikki is struggling, right, to make that budget work. And, like, that's not okay. That's not okay. So stable, good organizations are what it's all about. And that's my little two, three, whatever. Oh, sorry, whatever it was.
Yeah, so what's popping up for me is reactive versus proactive action. And when I think about food, I saw a talk by Joel Salatin a couple years ago, and he had this graphic about 10 years ago, how much money Americans spent on food versus health care stuff, and now how much people spend on food versus health care stuff, right? And this direct inverse relationship between how much we put into proactively taking care of ourselves versus reactively taking care of ourselves feels like the food bank, right? And emergency food services and how do we equalize the pool when it comes to building sustainable systems that can hold people while providing emergency services for folks that fall off the wagon? And I feel like in the health world, it's the same thing. How much money do we put into preventative health care versus reactive health care? And it feels like a much larger conversation around our orientation in this country toward proactive versus reactive action. And when that conversation is able to shift en masse, which is why the systemic stuff that you've been talking about, Nick, is so important, there's only so much we can do in these little pockets of proactivity inside of a reactive system. And so making sure to work to actually shift the system into more proactivity is incredibly important.
I think, you know, a lot of the romance around the food system is about local food. And sometimes that can end up just meaning that the organizing and the thinking is very local and becomes, in fact, parochial. And it's just about this particular community. And even then, not everyone in that community and not even those relationships of power. And I think one way through that is through developing systemic thinking. Now, how do you do that? How do you have these political conversations? You need the organizations. You need the information. You need the knowledge. And so I think everyone here tonight, you know, the three things you do very clear is, you know, buy Nick's book, buy the Earth Island Journal, and support the People's Grocery.
And fund his communist project.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Let's give a big round of applause.
Good job.
That was Nick Saul, Raj Patel, Nikki Henderson for sharing their thoughts with us tonight for Food to Change the World. Now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.